You're listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit nakedbiblepodcast.com and click on the support link in the upper right-hand corner. If you're new to the podcast and Dr. Heiser's approach to the Bible, click on New Start Here at nakedbiblepodcast.com.
Welcome to the Naked Bible Podcast, episode 170, Melchizedek, part 3. I'm the layman, Trey Strickland, and he's the scholar, Dr. Michael Heiser. Hey, Mike, how you doing?
Pretty good. We're going to finally wrap up Melchizedek, at least, short of the Q&A anyway.
Yeah, and we've got one more week of voting left, and it looks like Hebrews is going to win if nothing drastic happens.
Yeah, that's kind of what I'm expecting, and that's going to affect what we do today, but it sort of looks like a clear winner, but who knows?
Absolutely. Well, I'm ready for part three if you are.
Sure. Well, let's just start with a summary. I mean, we've been through three previous episodes. We had part 1A, part 1B, and then, of course, part 2. 1A and 1B were Old Testament, the Old Testament material about Melchizedek, and part 2 was the Second Temple literature that was relevant to Melchizedek. And just by way of summarizing a few points that we hit along the way, we talked about how Melchizedek's name and his title was the King of Salem or Salem, and the location, of course, of Salem was associated with Jerusalem, that the name and that title sort of associate Melchizedek with kingship, obviously, Jerusalem, again, obvious, righteousness, peace, and of course, priesthood. Now, those are all sort of ingredients for how the Messiah gets talked about. And so they're factors for what we're going to talk about today with respect to what the New Testament does with Melchizedek in the book of Hebrews in chapter 7. So, you know, there's congruence there. We also talked about how the Aaronic priesthood is cast in Scripture as a concession by God. In other words, it was sort of a plan B because of Moses' unbelief. And we've trodden over this territory before, so I'm not going to make too much of it here. But the priesthood of Melchizedek is a legitimate priesthood. And we will talk a little bit more about that specifically, that idea anyway. But it's consistent with what we've already seen, that, hey, even though we have the priesthood of Aaron, the tribe of Levi, and all that sort of stuff, this other priesthood, the priesthood of Melchizedek, was legit. This isn't what the plan B was. It was the Aaronic line that was the plan B. And Melchizedek, again, combines kingship and priesthood all into one. And that, as we talked about earlier, was sort of the ideal. And we're going to get that in the Messiah, in the Messianic profile. We're going to get both sides, both elements. We also talked about the content matrix. This is a term I've used for sort of all the things that kind of glom on to Melchizedek in terms of theological content. So we've got Melchizedek, who, of course, is associated with Abraham, and Abraham's seed, of course, are the Israelites, and one particular seed is going to be the Messiah. Melchizedek is associated with Elyon, the Most High, which is a term that's also associated with Deuteronomy 32. Again, that term shows up in Deuteronomy 32, the divorce of the nations, and, of course, the flip side of that is the reclaiming of the nations, which is something that the Messiah would accomplish. So we have that set of data points in relation to Melchizedek. Melchizedek also, because of his association with Abraham, and if we bring Psalm 110 into the picture, we have an association with David in the Messianic dynasty, so he's associated with both of those major figures. David, again, would himself actually do some priestly things, but not a priestly line, but what God does is associate the Davidic dynasty with the priesthood of Melchizedek, the line of Melchizedek, and so that's why the Messiah gets associated with him. So we've got all these mutual associations. We've got, again, this thing that I refer to as a content matrix, all of these subjects sort of converging when it comes to Melchizedek, so that we have, again, this priest-king figure, again, associated with Jerusalem as well. And it is, again, just kind of an obvious profile. We have this combination of things we said earlier was consistent with kind of the Edenic ideal as well. Think of Adam. We have the original Edenic king in Adam. And we call him king because he was the one who was supposed to subdue the earth. He was supposed to rule the earth on God's behalf. And this is what the covenantal language associated with Adam says. his status also made him sort of a mediator on earth between God and the rest of humanity, his own descendants. Again, that was the original profile. That idea of combining rulership and mediation in one person continues through the patriarchs all the way up to Moses. Melchizedek becomes part of that profile, again, because of the incident with Abraham. But when you get to Moses, it splits. Again, the Aaronic priesthood is a concession. It's plan B. It's something that has to operate, you know, in the background or alongside because of Moses' unbelief. So all of those things are important. You know, when we come to, again, how to think about Melchizedek. The last element that I should mention, though, is that at no point in the Old Testament material do we get any impression that Melchizedek was a divine being. He's a human being. He's a priest. He's a king. I made the comment in a previous episode that he was the chief royal and priestly representative of the Most High God. That idea is actually going to become important for what we talk about today, really in explaining how in the world certain Jews during the Second Temple period began to view Melchizedek as a divine being. But again, the point at this juncture right here is the Old Testament itself doesn't really say that. It doesn't really call Melchizedek a divine being, but the fact that he is this main chief royal and priestly representative of the Most High God, again, in theory, between the Most High God and not just Abraham, but just generally, that is a significant idea, but it sort of gets misapplied or thought about incorrectly by some in the Second Temple period. Now, we know in the New Testament, which is what we're going to get into today, that Jesus and Melchizedek are going to be, you know, compared. But I'm going to argue, again, that the point of the comparison is to compare Melchizedek to Jesus, not Jesus to Melchizedek, and that this is going to be why we get some of this divine being sort of language, and really how to parse it so that it's consistent with the Old Testament. Because again, the Old Testament does not have Melchizedek as a divine being. Now, in order to sort of straighten this out and both talk about why this error was sort of made, at least by certain Jewish writers, as a way to both deal with that and then segue into what the New Testament actually does, we need to camp for a few minutes at least on how Second Temple Jewish writers sort of made this association, how they came to see Melchizedek as a divine being. So how did this happen? How does that trajectory occur? Well, there's really sort of two things we need to be thinking about in tandem. One is the fact that Melchizedek, by virtue of his role as priest and king, again, and his relationship to this scene with Abraham, Melchizedek is sort of thought about because of that stuff as being the chief representative of Israel before God. And you could see how that would happen. You know, this chief priest, chief king, the main priestly figure, the main dynastic ruler figure. Well, naturally, if he is that in God's eyes, then he would sort of be thought of as the chief representative of Israel to God and before God. Now, once that association is sort of entrenched in your head, that Melchizedek represents Israel before God as its king and priest figure, then another association gets factored into it. And here's where the problem happens. And that is, there is the prince language of the Old Testament. This association of priest, king with prince language, prince of Israel language, is how Melchizedek becomes a divine being in the minds of certain Second Temple Jews. Now, we need to unpack that. Here's how it's done. There are certain passages that use Prince of Israel language. Daniel 10:21. Who is Israel's prince in Daniel 10:21? Well, it's Michael. It's the Archangel Michael. Now, Michael, of course, isn't called an archangel in the Old Testament. He gets that title in the New Testament and also in the Second Temple period. But Israel's prince is Michael in Daniel 10:21. You get the same idea in Daniel 12:1, where Michael is the great prince who has charge of your people. Again, angel speaking to Daniel. So there you have Michael is the great prince of the people of Israel. And so mentally, there were certain Jews that said, okay, Michael is the prince, you know, of Israel. And Melchizedek is the chief priestly representative and the chief royal ruling representative. This must be the same way, three different ways of talking about the same person. And so Michael becomes Melchizedek. There's another verse that gets factored into this, and this is in Joshua 5:14, where we have the prince of Yahweh's host. Now, some translations in English will have the captain of the Lord's host, or the commander of the Lord's host, or the commander of the Lord's armies, something like that. And this is clearly in Joshua 5. This is clearly a divine being, because when Joshua asks, hey, who are you? He says, well, I'm the prince. I'm the Tsar. It's the same word as in Daniel 10 and Daniel 12, of Yahweh's host. Take off your shoes, you know, from on your feet, you know, because this is holy ground. It takes you mentally back to Exodus 3, the burning bush, where we have the angel of the Lord. So this is how, you know, this sort of concatenation of ideas happens. You have this notion that because Melchizedek is the chief prince and priestly figure, the chief representative to God, not just to Abraham, but to the people of Israel, that chief representation idea gets merged or glommed onto or conflated with the language of the prince of Israel that occurs a couple times in Daniel 10 and Daniel 12. And so that's how Melchizedek and Michael sort of get fused or united in the mind, again, of some interpreters in antiquity, and also, you know, to be fair, some interpreters nowadays. Now, do you see the problematic assumption, though? Do you see what the problem is if you think that way? The figure in Joshua 5 is the prince of the Lord's host. He's the prince of the heavenly host. Whereas Michael, in Daniel 10, Daniel 12, is the prince of Israel, which is earthly. They're actually talking about two different things, but nevertheless, they get conflated as though it was the same thing. And that's the problem. That's the mistake. You cannot presume the figure of Joshua 5 and Michael are the same just because they're both called prince. But some ancient Jewish interpreters did, and some modern interpreters do as well now. Now, the identification of the figure of Joshua 5 and Michael is also marred or messed up by the description of Michael in Daniel 10:13. Here's why it's wrong. Here's why this association cannot be the case. On one hand, they're princes of different things. There's a disconnect. Joshua 5, that is the prince of Yahweh's host, his heavenly host. And Daniel 10, Daniel 12, Michael is the prince of Israel, which is an earthly people. So you have that disconnect, but there's another problem. That's Daniel 10:13, the way Michael's described there. Michael is described as one of the chief princes in Daniel 10:13. Now, if Michael is the prince, the commander of Yahweh's host in Joshua 5, if he's that guy, then that commander is but one of the commanders of Yahweh's host, because Michael is just one of the chief princes. So any of those other chief princes that aren't named could have been the captain, the commander of Yahweh's host back in Joshua 5. It just doesn't work. You don't have Michael elevated to a unique position. He's just one of a small group for sure. But if he's one of the chief princes, then the guy back in Joshua 5, and by extension, the one in the burning bush, is just one of several that hold that position, have that high status. And if that figure is just one of several princes, then you could have had any number, you know, again, at least more than one divine being occupying space with Yahweh in the burning bush. And that is just not the way that the angel of Yahweh is portrayed in the Old Testament. So that's actually a significant problem, having Daniel 10:13 tell us that Michael is just one of the chief princes, and he's not, you know, this unique status by himself. Michael is clearly, put it another way, he's clearly not the highest authority in the heavenly sphere. He assists the divine man, quote unquote, who speaks to Daniel in Daniel 10:13, Daniel 10:21. And again, he's just one of the chief princes. Now, that divine man, just a little bit of a rabbit trail here, the divine man back in Daniel, who's speaking to Daniel, I think is the prince of the host from Daniel 8:11, and also the prince of princes in Daniel 8:25. And that guy is not Michael. He ain't Michael. That figure outranks Michael, who is just one of the chief princes. And again, the prince not of the whole heavenly host, but he's the prince of Israel. The prince of the host, again, the whole heavenly host of Daniel 8:11, again, is not Michael. And frankly, that prince, the prince of the host, the prince of princes, Daniel 8:11, Daniel 8:25, that guy sounds an awful lot like the guy back in Joshua 5, who is the prince of Yahweh's heavenly host, Yahweh's army. So to sum that up, again, to try to summarize all that, Michael is not the highest authority in heaven under God. He is not the second Yahweh. The second Yahweh figure outranks him. And if that's the case, then Jesus, who is aligned with the angel of Yahweh, who is the second embodied Yahweh, cannot be Michael. And I know, you know, like traditions like Seventh-day Adventists want to fuse Jesus and Michael. There are significant problems to it, especially Daniel 10:13. Michael is just one of the chief princes. I'm sorry, but Jesus is unique. The second Yahweh is unique because he is Yahweh. And I realize I'm using Unseen Realm lingo here. If you're new to the podcast, you need to go back and read Unseen Realm. You need to, you know, the chapters on the word and the angel and the name and all that stuff, because this is where the idea of two Yahweh figures, you know, comes in. This is the Old Testament basis for the later Jewish teaching of two powers in heaven, two good guys, one of which was the lesser Yahweh. Okay. You have that figure, and that is not Michael. And so you have, you know, some significant disconnects. And to sort of marry Melchizedek to Michael kind of compounds the problem. You don't need Melchizedek to be Michael or any other divine being to make sense of what the New Testament says about Jesus and Melchizedek. You just don't need it. But a lot of people sort of go down this road because they're thinking, based on what they read in Hebrews 7, that we have to have Melchizedek be a divine being, or else Hebrews 7 is wrong, and there's something going on there. And so, well, who could Melchizedek be that's a divine being? And some people will land on Michael like they did in the ancient world. And then you've got significant problems, because then you've got the captain of the Lord's host back in Joshua 5 being just one of several equal guys in heaven. And then you got real problems when you have to import that back into the burning bush with the angel of the Lord, because the same language, take your shoes off, you know, from off your feet because you're standing on holy ground, the same language is used in both places. So when you try to unite these things, really on the basis of the word prince, okay, you've got problems. So where I'm at here is Michael is different than Melchizedek. Michael is different, okay, than the prince of the host and the prince of princes. Michael is just what the scripture says he is. He's the prince of Israel. He is never called the prince of Yahweh's host, the whole thing. He is not the prince over the whole host. He is the prince of Israel. That's what he's called. So let's not conflate these figures, and we can avoid some, you know, serious theological problems. And then going back to Melchizedek, to repeat what I just said, you don't need Melchizedek to be a divine being in the Old Testament to have Hebrews 7 make sense. And that's where we're going to go now. Again, this is an episode that we need to orient to the New Testament, and the two passages are the end of Hebrews 6 and on into Hebrews 7. So let's read those. I'm going to read Hebrews 6, 13 through 20, which says this: "For when God made a promise to Abraham, since he had no one greater by whom to swear, he swore by himself, saying, 'Surely I will bless you and multiply you.' And thus Abraham, having waited patiently, obtained the promise. For people swear by something greater than themselves, and in all their disputes an oath is final for confirmation. So when God desired to show more convincingly to the heirs of the promise the unchangeable character of his purpose, he guaranteed it with an oath, so that by two unchangeable things in which it is impossible for God to lie, we who have fled for refuge might have strong encouragement to hold fast the hope set before us. We have this as a sure and steadfast anchor of the soul, a hope that enters into the inner place behind the curtain, where Jesus has gone as a forerunner on our behalf, having become a high priest forever after the order of Melchizedek." Now on into Hebrews 7, starting with verse 1. "For this Melchizedek, king of Salem," or Salem, "priest of the Most High God, met Abraham returning from the slaughter of the kings, and blessed him. And to him Abraham apportioned a tenth part of everything. He is first, by translation of his name, king of righteousness. And then he is also king of Salem, that is, king of peace. He is without father or mother or genealogy, having neither beginning of days nor end of life, but resembling the Son of God, he continues a priest forever. See how great this man was to whom Abraham the patriarch gave a tenth of the spoils. Now, I'm going to stop there, in part because, again, it looks like we're going to be doing Hebrews, going through the whole book of Hebrews on the podcast. I want to focus on the language here used about Jesus and Melchizedek for this particular episode, because, you know, frankly, this is really what the episode is about. There are two interpretive options in scholarship for what I just read. We can either take what I just read literally, or we can look at it allegorically, okay, or analogically might be a better way to say it. And I'm going to just read a few excerpts from some commentaries here just so that you see the difference between those two options. So the first one here is from Peter O'Brien, his commentary, The Letter to the Hebrews in the Pillar New Testament Commentary Series. He writes, "These remarkable words have been understood in two significantly different ways. The first approach interprets without father or mother as divine predicates, which were well known in Hellenistic sources. Without genealogy signifies unbegotten or uncreated and therefore of divine generation. While the crucial statement without beginning of days or end of life means that he was truly God and not merely a divinized mortal. On this view, Melchizedek is a divine figure, a heavenly being who is not part of this world." So again, that's one way, that's the end of the quotation. That's one way you can read this material in Hebrews 7. Of course, the problem is there's no hint of any of that in the Old Testament. Second Temple, you run into it, you know, here and there, like 11Q Melchizedek, but if you remember the episode we did on the Second Temple period, there were other Second Temple writers that didn't think Melchizedek was divine at all. They just cast him as a normal guy. So there was a difference of opinion there. But again, if you can read Hebrews 7 that way. Now, picking up with O'Brien again, here's the second way you can read it. The second approach takes the author's statements as an example of an argument from silence in a typological setting. Let me just break in here. So now we're talking about typology here. And again, for those who may not recall or don't know, a type is a nonverbal prophecy. It is something in the Old Testament, a person, an event, an institution that foreshadows or prefigures something yet to come. It's an analogy to something yet to come. Back to Lane's quotation. I'll just start from where I was at. The second approach takes the author's statements as an example of an argument from silence in a typological setting. If the first clause, quote, without father or mother, without genealogy, unquote, is understood in purely human terms within a Greco-Roman context, then this would discredit Melchizedek. Without father meant being considered illegitimate. Someone without a mother was the child of a woman of low social status. And without genealogy meant that one was disqualified from being a Levitical priest, according to Numbers 3, verse 10, and verses 15 and 16. So that's the end of the quotation. What do we do with this? Because neither alternative seems really that great. The keys to unraveling this passage, you know, the end of Hebrews 6 and Hebrews 7, without disrespecting Melchizedek, without making him an illegitimate, you know, kid or something like that, but yet also honoring the fact that the Old Testament does not cast him as a divine being. The keys to sort of navigating this, there's really two things. Let's just start with the first one, again, in my view, and those are the words without genealogy. That's an important qualifier because the point would be priestly qualification. Okay, not having a genealogy does not refer to a supernatural nature of Melchizedek. Okay, that he had no parentage or something like that. We'll get to the, you know, the other phrasing here. But without genealogy refers to the lack of a priestly qualification. Now, O'Brien, back to him, says this: although Melchizedek could not have qualified for the Levitical priesthood, okay, he wasn't, you know, a Levitical. There was no tribe of Levi. Okay, this is Abraham's time. Melchizedek could not have qualified for the Levitical priesthood. He was still priest of God Most High, and Abraham recognized this. Moreover, since Genesis says nothing about Melchizedek's birth or death, his priesthood is cast as having no beginning or end. It was a divinely appointed priesthood that never ended. So you see the point here. You can take the language and say, oh, this refers to Melchizedek's origin as a human being. You know, well, he's not really human because he didn't have parents. He's a divine being. Now, well, I mean, you can take it that way, but what O'Brien is saying, and again, where I'm landing, is that no, this description refers to a priesthood God created that has no beginning other than when God had Abraham, you know, encounter this meeting. It had no genealogical beginning. It isn't rooted in parentage. It isn't rooted in tribal affiliation. It is a priesthood because God says it is. It has nothing to do with human origin or human lineage or human tribal affiliation. And that is the point. When we get this description about having no father or no mother, the point is not to claim that Melchizedek is a supernatural being. The point is to claim that he doesn't have a genealogy that fits the priesthood, and it doesn't matter. He is a priest of the Most High God because God said so. God approved of him. It had nothing to do with his birth circumstances at all. And not only that, by not giving us the father and the mother, by casting it this way, this is, you know, O'Brien's point, by casting it this way, it creates the implication, it suggests that this priesthood has no end to it. If it's not linked to human lineage, then by definition, it's not going to be terminated when that tribal lineage dies or that tribal lineage can't be determined by whatever, you know, historical circumstance. It's independent of that. So again, if you read it that way, again, you sort of avoid some of the other problems, and it makes sense in its context. Now, again, if I would summarize this in my way, again, this is me talking here, you know, just in by way of summary, the implication is that Melchizedek was still the priest of the Most High, regardless of ancestry. That's the fundamental point. There's no need to worry about Jesus, therefore, not being from the tribe of Levi and still being called a priest. This is a different priesthood, approved by God, one that is cast the way it is because it didn't originate with a tribe, and it's never described as having ended. The Old Testament is silent on Melchizedek's lineage and parentage for that reason. Again, this is the argument. It's silent on his mother and father because his priesthood does not depend on human lineage or tribal affiliation. It is not silent so that we can claim that or think that Melchizedek was a divine being. Now, as such, the physical succession to Jesus of Nazareth is not an issue. We don't even have to have Melchizedek related to Jesus to make the connection with Melchizedek legitimate. It doesn't matter because God has chosen this priesthood. That's why in Psalm 110, when God says to the dynasty of David, you know, you're going to be a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek, God just decided that. That's God's decision. I'm going to make you son of David, David dynastic offspring. I'm going to make you a king, but I'm also going to make you a priest. And I'm going to select for the analogy for the legitimacy of your priesthood, this guy Melchizedek, because his priesthood was something I decided. It had nothing to do with physical lineage. So don't worry about it. You are a king and a priest. These are God's decisions. And what it really tells you, in my mind anyway, it really does speak again to the issue that the Aaronic priesthood was sort of an afterthought or a plan B or a concession because of Moses' unbelief. You know, God doesn't let that defeat his template, his ideal, going back to Adam, where you have king and priest in one person. That is still what God wants, regardless of the fact that he made a concession to Moses because Moses just couldn't believe and said, okay, you know, we'll make Aaron, you know, your spokesperson. Then, you know, Aaron becomes the high priest. You know, God was merciful to Moses. And that's where we get the Aaronic priesthood. God doesn't need to stick with plan B to get what God wants. God goes back to the order of Melchizedek to merge the office of king and priest into one. Again, God's allowed to do that because he's God. You know, he endorses what he endorses. So we don't need to worry about questions of physical succession for Jesus to Melchizedek or anything like that. This whole thing was dictated by God alone. The silence of the Old Testament creates the impression, deliberately, that Melchizedek did not inherit his priestly service from a predecessor, and he remained a priest without a successor. His priestly line, in God's mind, is still in place and legitimate. It doesn't depend on a predecessor or a successor. And that's why the Old Testament is silent on Melchizedek's lineage. That's why the writer of Hebrews 7 says, without father or mother, having no genealogy. That's the point. The point is not to paint him as a supernatural being. Now back to O'Brien, just another little snippet from him. He says, consequently, Melchizedek foreshadows the priesthood of Christ at that point where it is most fundamentally different from the Levitical priesthood. In other words, it is a priesthood not dependent on tribal lineage. And end of quote. So that, I think, is the first thing that really helps understand, unravel what's going on in Hebrews 7 without making Melchizedek into something he's not. He's not a divine being, and he's not an illegitimate child either. This is how we need to approach it and read it, and it makes good sense. Now, the second item in Hebrews 7 is in verse 3. There's a phrase in verse 3 where we read that resembling the Son of God, he, Melchizedek, becomes a priest forever. Now, note the wording. It is Melchizedek who resembles the Son of God. The point is not that Jesus resembles Melchizedek. And because Melchizedek resembles Jesus, his priesthood, Melchizedek's priesthood, is to be understood as being independent of lineage. Again, it's just another way of arguing the same thing. His priesthood is one begun by God and never terminated. And so while Second Temple texts thought about Melchizedek in divine terms, and the reason for doing so was wrong, it was just misguided, the notion is still valid if one sees how the Messiah was a priest according to Melchizedek's priesthood, and that the Messiah, not Melchizedek, was the one who was divine. In other words, the idea that Melchizedek has something to do with a divine Messiah, that there's some relationship between Melchizedek and a divine Messiah, that's on target, but not because Melchizedek himself was more than a man. It's on target because Jesus, the Son of David, was more than a man. Now, again, that's sort of flipping it on its head, but I'm hoping, again, that you see the coherence of approaching it this way. A different commentator here, Lane, in his Word Biblical Commentary on Hebrews, he talks about a little bit about some of the finer grammatical points in Hebrews 7. And for those of you who have a little bit of knowledge of Greek, I think you'll appreciate this. Lane notes, quote, the events in Genesis have been read from the perspective of the eschatological reality they prefigured. Melchizedek has been assimilated to the Son of God. This is me breaking in now again. It's not that Jesus gets assimilated to Melchizedek. It's that Melchizedek gets assimilated to Jesus. Okay, back to Lane. This implies that the predicates applied to Melchizedek have been colored by the writer's conception of the eternal Son, Jesus. That explains why the description of Melchizedek in verse 3 appears singularly stylized. The perfect passive participle, and the Greek here is apho moi omenos, is a divine passive. This is me breaking in now. That's a grammatical term that some commentators use, okay? The perfect passive participle is a divine passive, translated having resembled, more literally, having resembled the Son of God, having been made by God to resemble the Son of God. The term presupposes God's appointment of Melchizedek as an illustration. I actually like the word a foreshadowing or a type, an illustration of the higher priesthood that the writer finds in the Old Testament record. The Genesis 14 narrative thus implies the kind of priesthood that was intended by God to displace the Levitical priesthood, namely the service of an eternal priest who exercises his priesthood continuously. It anticipates the appearance of a high priest who does not have any successor because he doesn't require one, unquote. And again, this is what the writer of Hebrews sees. He's looking at Jesus first, and then he's thinking about Melchizedek. He's not looking at Melchizedek and then thinking about Jesus. So we need to be careful, again, how we articulate this, how we read it and articulate it. The point again, is that Melchizedek was made by God to resemble the Son of God who would come down the road. Melchizedek is a type, a prefigurement of the Son of God who would come. This doesn't require Melchizedek be divine any more than we have to see Adam as a divine being, because he functions as a type, a prefigurement of Jesus in Romans 5. Remember Romans 5, Jesus and, you know, the first and second Adam, all that talk. Well, you know, Adam wasn't a divine being. He was a human. Okay. But Adam is a type of Christ. Adam doesn't need to be divine to function as a type of Christ. Well, neither does Melchizedek. Melchizedek was not a divine being in the Old Testament, and he doesn't need to be to do the job of prefiguring the Son of God, you know, who would be an eternal priest, an eternal mediator between God and men. Okay. The writer of Hebrews is thinking about Jesus in those terms, and his mind is taken back to Melchizedek, not the other way around. So the part about Abraham paying tithes to Melchizedek, I think, validates the point. This Melchizedek was a legitimate priest of the Most High who deserved the tithe just like Levi would later. He preceded Levi, and his priesthood didn't extend from tribal lineage and never met an end. It coexisted once the Levitical priesthood appeared. It never went away. And the fact that it did, again, suggests that the Aaronic priesthood was a concession. Now, lastly, had any reader of Hebrews in antiquity known the chronology of Jesus' birth, and we've talked about this a lot on the podcast, I think that point, this point about his priesthood being transcended to Levi, would have been driven home even more. That Jesus was the one to bring atonement and set the captives free by means of the connection of those ideas to the Jubilee cycle would have been highlighted by God's eternal foresight and use of Melchizedek to foreshadow someone who would be both the son of David and a priestly mediator considered by God to be superior to the line of Aaron. Now, how does that work? And what about the birth? Well, for this, you need to be familiar with, again, my position. This is not just my position, but, you know, my position that Jesus was born on September 11th in 3 BC. Now, we devoted a whole podcast episode to that. It's episode number 138 as to why, you know, that's the case. And we provided newsletter subscribers anyway. So please subscribe to the newsletter and you get access to this. We provided newsletter subscribers with scholarly literature that validate that this position is not a contradiction. It's not irreconcilable with Herod's death. There's a way to, you know, to do the chronology there so that it works, based on Herodian coins and a few other things that are, you know, problems in Josephus that other scholars have tackled in the peer-reviewed literature. So if you want that stuff, subscribe to the newsletter, you'll get it. Go back and listen to episode 138. So given that little bit of context, after the second Ezekiel 40 through 48 podcast that we did, that was about, you know, me arguing really that the temple vision there should be viewed as, you know, viewed non-literally to get our heads inside the Jubilee idea, because there are 60 references to Jubilee stuff in Ezekiel 40 through 48, 60 of them, actually a little over 60. That's not an accident, folks. When you do it that many times, there's something going on there. There are over 60 links between the idealized temple and the Jubilee cycle idea. After we did that episode, I got a question from Matthew in California that asked whether 3 BC, again, the birth year of Jesus, was a Jubilee year. Now, the idea he was angling for was that the birth of Jesus would have marked the Jubilee cycle. So what I did was I asked my astronomer friend, and for those of you who read my fiction, this is my Mantello character. I asked my astronomer friend about it and got back a really, really interesting answer. Okay, so here's part of his answer. He wrote, "The year from 2 BC to 1 BC would have been a sabbatical year. The year 27 to 28 CE, or that's another way to mark AD, was also a sabbatical year and a Jubilee year, which means the birth year could not be a Jubilee year." So that was the answer to Matthew's question in California, and I sent that to him. But my source, my astronomer, continues. He says, "The 27-28 CE or AD period, the Jubilee period, coincides with the beginning of Jesus' ministry, which was inaugurated at the event in the synagogue at Nazareth, Luke 4:14-16, even a little bit more beyond that. This is where Jesus quotes Isaiah 61 about the Jubilee language being fulfilled today in your hearing. That's what Jesus said. Today, you know, today in your hearing, this passage has been fulfilled. Now, there's some variability here. Some scholars, this is me talking now, some scholars, namely Trokme and Yoder, have the Jubilee year at 27 or 26, as opposed to 28, 27. Jesus' inaugural sermon would have probably have begun either in 26 or 27. Let's just put it in either one of those years. We'll overlap both those figures, because at any rate, either of those dates align with a 3 BC birth and the statement in Luke 3:23, where Jesus, when he began his ministry, was, quote, about 30 years of age. So it aligns actually pretty nicely. Now think about the implications. Jesus walks into the synagogue in Nazareth to launch his ministry in a Jubilee year. He knows it's a Jubilee year. Then he quotes Isaiah 61, stopping at Isaiah 61, verse 2, the first part of the verse. This is one of the passages that was central to 11Q Melchizedek. We talked about this in our last Melchizedek episode. They viewed 11Q Melchizedek, the writer there, viewed the coming of the Messiah was the coming of the Elohim of Psalm 82, who was about to set the captives free in fulfillment of the Jubilee idea. They read all of that. They read Psalm 82. If you remember the 11Q Melchizedek stuff, it gets into the war of gods and men and the allotment of, you know, the lot of Belial and the lot of Melchizedek, the good guys and the bad guys having this great conflict. Again, because the Messiah is supposed to set the captives free, set the nation free. That requires conquest and overthrow of their overlords. So they're processing the whole thing militarily. They process Psalm 82, Isaiah 61, all that through the vengeance, you know, of God. But that's actually where Jesus stopped. Let me just read you. Let me just go to Isaiah 61 to get our memories refreshed. Here's Isaiah 61. The Spirit of the Lord God is upon me. And this is the passage Jesus reads. And as he inaugurates, he begins his ministry. Because the Lord has anointed me to bring good news to the poor. He has sent me to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim liberty to the captives, and the opening of the prison to those who are bound, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor. And that's where he stops. The very next line is, and the day of vengeance of our God. And that's what Jews of the period had in their head. But Jesus actually stops. He doesn't quote that part of Isaiah 61. Why? Because what he's there for, his liberation of the captives, is wider and frankly more significant than military conquest. Humanity was to be liberated from spiritual darkness and estrangement from God because of what he was going to do. He quotes this passage but excludes the day of vengeance of our God, because what he's thinking about is much bigger than that. So now think about all of that and what we said earlier about the content matrix with Melchizedek. You have Melchizedek. He blesses Abraham. He blesses Abraham's seed. He is priest of Elyon, the Most High. The Most High God was the one who disinherited the nations in Deuteronomy 32. This particular seed of Abraham, Jesus, son of Abraham, also son of David, was the one who would reclaim those nations. Because he was also the son of David, the son of Abraham, remember that the passages we read in the Old Testament sections about how these references to the scepter by virtue of Psalm 110, the scepter not departing, you know, from the king. And I mean, he's the son of Abraham. He's the son of David. He's a king and a priest. He gets associated with Melchizedek, who was also a king and a priest. And Melchizedek was the king of, you know, of Jerusalem, the priest of Jerusalem. So there you get the Zion association there, all that together. Again, this is what the Messiah, the Messianic dynasty, was supposed to be. Jesus was a high priest, a mediator, and a king. He's the mediator according to Melchizedek's priesthood, the king according to the dynasty of David. He is the mediator between humanity and the Most High. He was the specific seed of Abraham who would reclaim the nations for the Most High. He was the son of David, whom Psalm 89, verse 27 said, would be made the Most High Son of David over the nations. And his ministry, all of that, that's who he is. And it all began. The enactment of who he was and what it meant all began in Nazareth in a Jubilee year, again with Jesus quoting Isaiah 61. Now that sort of planning, that sort of having all those threads converge and come together in this person, Jesus of Nazareth, if people were aware of that or even part of it, they're going to be looking at Jesus just like the writer of Hebrews did. This guy is superior in every way to the line of Aaron. and the tribe of Levi. His dynasty was promised, again, to be an eternal dynasty, a never-ending dynasty. In other words, it's not going to be terminated. And his priesthood is also never-ending, because he is a priest after the order of Melchizedek by God's own decision. And that priesthood had no predecessor and no successor. And again, you look at all of these circumstances, all of these threads converging. Again, if we had these things in our head, we would look at Jesus just the way the writer of Hebrews did, like I just said, that this is something greater, far greater, both in terms of who he was and God's unbelievably magnificent planning to bring all this together. This one is greater and represents a greater truth than Aaron and the law and the ritual and the priesthood of Levi. There's just no comparison. And that's really the fundamental point in Hebrews 7 about Jesus and his relationship to Melchizedek.
All right, Mike. Well, that's a lot of Melchizedek. I'm sure we'll be covering more as we get into Hebrews if everything holds steady on the voting.
Yeah, there's more in Hebrews 7, again, to talk about. But since that's pretty much the way it looks like, unless we have a flurry of interest in another book, we'll return to Hebrews 7 and pick up the other stuff.
All right, that sounds good. And also, don't forget, please, if you have a question over the three parts of Melchizedek that we've covered, send me a question at treystrickland@gmail.com. We've got about a week. I guess next week, Mike, we've got a regular QA coming up. And then the week after that, we'll have the Melchizedek Q&A. So that gives people at least a week to get me questions if they have any questions on the New Testament part of Melchizedek. Yeah. But I've already got some questions. We can't answer everybody's questions, so just know that. But we will pick a handful out, Mike, and hopefully that'll add more to the conversation or more.
Yeah, somebody's gonna turn over a rock on something.
We shall find
out.
We'll
find out.
We shall see. All right, sounds good, Mike. We'll be looking forward to that Q&A. And I guess with that, I just want to thank everybody for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. God bless.
Thanks for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit www.nakedbibleblog.com. To learn more about Dr. Heiser's other websites and blogs, go to www.drmsh.com.